Very good. All right, Mark, thank you very much. It sounds like people are still coming on the line, so I just want to make a couple of announcements, and then I'll introduce myself after that.
Okay, Bruce, it's time to get going.
Pardon me?
Bruce, I'm turning it over to you.
Thank you very much. Okay, again, I'd like to reiterate, please, right now, anybody who's on the line, please press your mute button. Anyone who's on the line right now, all people online, I can still hear noises coming from someone's phone. Please press the mute button on your phone. I still hear sounds from someone's phone. It would be great if all the mute buttons were on. Thank you. Sounds like, all right, it's very quiet now. Thank you so much. And also, please, as Mark said, we once had a hold button pressed.
Tanya Lay.
We once, please, everyone, put your phone on mute immediately. We've had entire phone calls inaudible because of mute buttons not being pressed. And we've also had entire calls obliterated by being on hold music. So thank you so much in advance for not using your hold button, and thank you very much for putting your phone on mute. I am also going to make a few more announcements. This is the biggest group we've ever had for a call like this. We have 32 people signed up for continuing education. Those of you who have communicated with me already have gotten an email in response, and you have also gotten the handouts, the most current handouts. So please follow those handouts, those slides. Again, I hear some sound in the background. Please be sure to put your mute buttons on as soon as possible, because I think there are more than 50 people on the call at this point in time, and even the slightest noises can interrupt the call. So
make a comment.
Please put your phone on mute, everyone. There's still some rattling around in the background, so please put your phones on mute. Thank you very much. All right. So my name is Bruce Lees. I am the member at large for Division 50, the member at large for practice, and I couldn't think of a more appropriate way to make good use of that position than to try to do as much as I can for members. This is just one example. We're going to try to expand some of the things we do for members, particularly who are in practice in Division 50. When this call is over, this is kind of just a test conference call. When this call is over, those who are getting credit for the call are going to be asked to complete an evaluation. And one of the questions on the evaluation is whether or not you would want a follow-up program. And that for that program, you would be able to get 3 credits, and we're going to keep building on that. So, again, these are kind of administrative tasks. I can still hear somebody moving around out there. Please, please, please put your phone on mute, because there are more than 50 people on the call now, and we can hear everything you're doing. All right. When we are complete, when this call is over, if you're one of the people who signed up for credit, all you need to do is to send me an email in response to the email I just sent you a little while ago. And that email simply needs to say, I attest to the fact that I was on the entire call, and I will send you a link to evaluate this conference call. And after you receive that link and fill out the forms, we'll make sure you're a member. And then we will send you your 1 credit. Again, there's somebody on the line who is not muted. Please mute your phone. Thank you. All right. So welcome, everybody. The name of this clinical conference call is What to Consider When CBT for Addictions Isn't Working. I have a lot of slides to go through. There are 29. That gives me about a minute and a half for each one, but some of them are real brief, real quick. So, I like to follow the old tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them rule. So I am going to jump right to my summary and conclusions and tell you what it says there, and then I'm going to try to tell you, and then I'm going to tell you what I told you. So on page 13 of the handout, slide number 26, under summary and conclusions, you see that what I say is that cognitive behavioral therapy is effective, but not all CBTs are effective for all people. And that's why I think a conference call like this can be so helpful. Not all cognitive behavioral therapies are effective for all people. The how to do cognitive behavioral therapy literature is massive, like how to do DBT, how to do cognitive therapy, how to do ACT, how to do all the CBTs. That literature, with the how-to literature, is massive. But the what to do when CBT doesn't work literature is pretty small. If you really want to dig into it, what you have to do is look for literature that has to do with common factors and therapist effects and therapeutic ruptures and supervision. Supervision in particular, because so much of supervision is to establish what to do when therapy isn't working. What do we say when we are having trouble working well with an individual patient? We say we need to get some supervision on this. So there's a lot of good information in those areas, but there really isn't a literature on what to do when psychotherapy in general doesn't work. It's a very complex question. I've moved to slide 27 on page 14. It's a very complex question. And what I like to do is to focus microscopically on a bunch of questions to try to answer that question. What do we do when psychotherapy isn't working or CBT isn't working? Again, this is kind of a summary, and then we're going to go over all the main slides. When CBT isn't working, it's important to look at what cognitive, affective, behavioral, and contextual patterns surround the addictions, like anxiety and depression and loneliness. It's important to look at what functions addictive behaviors serve. What are the barriers to change? How is the therapist responding to these barriers? And really, how skillful is the therapist? And I think with that said, as kind of a backdrop for what the entire presentation will be, let's move now to the first page of the handout.
Pardon the intrusion. This is Lynn Northrup from San Diego. I just joined the call.
Okay. Everyone, please put your phone on mute. So starting with slide number 2, page 1, how effective is treatment? CBT for addictions is clearly effective. Cognitive behavioral therapy for addictions is clearly effective, but there is no therapy that's 100% effective, and that's why discussions like these are so important. It's important to acknowledge that different people respond differently to different treatment modalities. Some are more effective for some people and not so much for others. So here we're talking about treatment overall, not just therapy. Some people benefit from therapy. Some people benefit most from mutual help groups. Some people benefit most from medication-assisted therapies or medication for opioid use disorders. And some people just benefit from their own self-guided change. So knowing that psychotherapy isn't the only or necessarily the most effective treatment for everyone, the question of why CBT is effective at all comes up. And again, people respond differently to even the same CBT. If one person or one therapist is doing a particular kind of CBT, not everyone is going to respond well to that. Some people really benefit most from highly structured therapies. Some people benefit from much less structured therapies. Some people benefit most from very directive therapists, and some people benefit from non-directive therapists. There are people who benefit from close therapy relationships, and as I write here, some people not so much. Some people benefit from very specific techniques like thought records, advantages, disadvantages, analysis, scheduling, behavioral activation. Those are all techniques, specific techniques that really benefit some people and don't benefit everybody. The implication here is that a therapist's range is vitally important. The extent to which a therapist can move comfortably from one set of techniques or one approach within CBT to another is extremely important. So we'll get to more of that, and we'll get to that in more detail here momentarily. But what makes a clinician think the therapy isn't working? Well, when patients say they're committed to change, but they continue to engage in problematic behavior or addictive behavior, or they make initial changes and then they keep relapsing, those when that occurs in patients, that may make a clinician think therapy is not working. When a patient or client repeatedly describes barriers to change, I can't do it because of this, I can't do it because of that, that can make a clinician think that therapy is not working. When patients don't do their homework that they've agreed to do, some clinicians might think therapy is not working. When they say they can't think of anything to work on, they come to a session and they say, I don't know, I guess everything's okay. That may make us think that therapy is not working. Missing sessions, regularly coming late to them, seeming disinterested, detached. All of those patient behaviors can lead a clinician to think that therapy is not working. In particular, it's important to be attentive to the therapist's own reaction. Sometimes patients trigger therapist boredom or frustration or detachment during sessions, and that most certainly will make a clinician think something's not right here. If I start to feel bored or frustrated, or you start to feel detached during a session, these are all potential signs interpretable as this isn't working. I said earlier that there is not a gigantic literature on when psychotherapy fails, but I was able to find a couple of articles, and one by Markowitz and Milrod, actually in the psychiatry literature in Lancet, had an interesting quote, and I thought I'd include it here. As you can see on page 3, slide number 5, sometimes patients withdraw from unhelpful treatment, but if they do not, the therapist and patient might continue a resigned, hobbled dance in which neither of them believes. A resigned, hobbled dance in which neither of them believes. Clinicians can fall back on vague, interminable, unarticulated, and unfocused so-called supportive therapy, comforting themselves with the hope that some human contact and support is probably better than nothing. But such treatment could consolidate chronicity and risk creating dependence on the therapist that is never addressed or worked through, worsening the patient's sense of helplessness and powerlessness. So again, there are a bunch of things that could make us think therapy isn't working. And if we just fall back on supportive therapy, there's a chance we'll just be reinforcing or exacerbating or at least maintaining the patient's difficulties and despair. You can see that I have on pages 3 through 5 put some case studies in here. It was kind of fun writing these. I wrote these from the composites, of course, of people I've seen over time. But case study 1 and case study 2 look exactly alike, except Mrs. Brown, in her 60s, was referred by her physician for help with alcohol use, gambling, and cigarette smoking. She readily admits to a history of IV drug use for 30 years ago, but she hasn't used IV drugs since then. So in case study number 1, Mrs. Brown comes in. She talks about her drinking. She admits to drinking vodka daily and smoking a pack of cigarettes a day and gambling several times a week, and this is a real composite of real patients that I've really seen. Near the end of the session, when asked for feedback, she says, wow, this really helps. What you're doing really helps me. That's why I keep coming back. Other therapists have blank, and that didn't help me. Case study number 1 and case study number 2 are exactly the same, except in case study number 2, Mrs. White drinks a 6-pack of beer daily. The difference between what they insert into that blank space, done therapy differently, Mrs. Brown is really, really pleased that her therapist just sits and listens. She really likes that she can vocalize what's disturbing her and kind of sort out in her own head what her problems are, particularly with addictions. And she says that the other therapists haven't helped her because they insist that she needs to be abstinent. They insist that she needs to try these exercises and receive psychoeducation. So in case study 1, she's really pleased with a more of an MI, cognitive behavioral therapy approach, where there's lots of support and reinforcement. She really likes that. But in case study number two, Mrs. White has received that in the past, and she feels like it's just placebo. Her experience is that this therapist who's helping her in case study number two, which happens to be the same therapist, is a lot more directive. This therapist says, you know, it's important to set deadlines for yourself. Let's do some self-monitoring. So in case study one and case study two, opposite approaches are taken. And in both cases, the patient says, this is really good when I've gotten the other approach to CBT. It hasn't helped me at all. Case study three is similar. Case studies three and four, after 12 visits, husband and wife coming in, the husband said, things are pretty good. And in response, the therapist says, well, if things are pretty good, we can stop therapy. But since you're here, and then they go on. In the next visit, case study number three, Mr. Smith doesn't show up. Only Mrs. Smith shows up. And what she says is that Mr. Smith is not coming back again. He feels like you dismissed us. Mr. Smith feels like by saying, at some point, if things are pretty good, we can stop therapy, he was insulted and he marched out and never came back. So Ms. Smith followed up with the psychologist. Interestingly, in case study number four, Mr. Jones and his wife, Ms. Jones, they came to the exact same therapist and got the exact same feedback. When Mr. Jones said, oh, I don't know what I want to work on, things are pretty good, and the therapist said, at some point when things are pretty good, you can stop therapy, both of them came back, and Mr. Jones and Ms. Jones thought that was really important, that the therapist said, you know, you can stop therapy when there's nothing else going on, because they realized they had a lot going on. So the points of case studies 1, 2, 3, and 4 is that the exact same behaviors with people with the exact problems can have opposite effects on patients, depending on all kinds of variables that we'll talk about shortly. Case study 5 is really an interesting scenario, because case study number 5, Ms. Clark in her 50s has lived a pretty rough life, and she's got a lot of trauma, and she's seen the same therapist for years. And she stopped a bunch of her addictive behaviors, but she really, really struggles with gambling. She keeps gambling. She's lost a lot of money on it, and it doesn't look like she's going to stop in the near future. And just when the therapist is ready to give up and says, what are you getting out of this? Ms. Clark says, you know, if it weren't for you, I'd gamble even more. I'd gamble every single day, and by now I'd be living under a bridge. So even though I'm not doing any of the things we talk about to stop my gambling, your relapse prevention techniques, a phrase she does not use, but you understand clearly as the therapist, you're kind of keeping me stable. So those are 5 case studies of people who kind of illustrate that sometimes no matter what you do, I shouldn't say no matter what you do, sometimes you do your best to do the right thing, and one group of people says that's the best thing that ever happened to me, and some people say that's the worst therapy I ever could have imagined getting. So given that as a backdrop to the sense that CBT for addictions isn't working, let's spend some time talking about CBT. We're starting to get into the things now that I'm pretty passionate about. So I like to ask the question, what is CBT? Because a lot of people have the misconception that cognitive behavioral therapy is a single approach to therapy. My guess is that everyone on the line here knows more accurately that there are many cognitive behavioral therapies. I could list probably dozens and dozens, but for the moment I'll just list cognitive therapy and rational emotive therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy, as you can see on the list. Behavioral activation could be considered a cognitive behavioral therapy. DBT, CPT, contingency management, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. These are all cognitive behavioral therapies. I'm going to talk about that in more detail a little bit later also. These are all different cognitive behavioral therapies. The differences between them are really their focal points. What I want to talk about now is the fact that just as cognitive behavioral therapies, they should all have at least 5 essential components. And you can see what these are right here in front of you on slide 12, page 6. The essential components of cognitive behavioral therapy are structure, collaboration, case conceptualization, psychoeducation, and specific techniques. Whether you are a rational emotive behavior therapist, an ACT therapist, a behavioral activation therapist, a dialectical behavior therapist, whatever you are, hopefully your sessions have structure, which includes organization, good use of time, good focus, consistency from session to session. Hopefully you collaborate, you set goals and expectations jointly, you conceptualize patients well, and conceptualization is pretty strongly influenced by a number of variables, but one of them is your own kind of home CBT. If your home model for CBT is acceptance and commitment therapy, there's a good chance that you will conceptualize patients with emphasis on acceptance and commitment. If you are a behavioral activation therapist, your case conceptualization might focus more on, behavioral aspects of the person's life. So essential components, structure, collaboration, case conceptualization, psychoeducation, all cognitive behavioral therapies are psychoeducational to the extent that they transmit salient knowledge and skills from therapist to patient, like the explanation that acceptance and commitment therapy works because it relies on sort of acknowledgement that there are some things in life you just have to accept, and behavioral activation, psychoeducation might be around the fact that you will be unhappy and you might engage in maladaptive or unhealthy behaviors if you don't have behaviors that more align with your value system, and then specific techniques. And those are oftentimes dependent on the specific CBT approach. So again, cognitive behavioral therapy isn't a single approach to therapy. It's a whole lot of different therapies. And the essential components really should be kept in mind. And the reason why these essential components should be kept in mind is that when therapy, the title of the talk here, when CBT doesn't seem like it's working, one way to determine what's going on is to look at these components. Is my structure appropriate for this patient? Do we have a collaborative, are we in a collaborative endeavor where we all understand the goals and expectations? Is my conceptualization thorough enough? Does it take into account enough of the different variables in a person's life? Am I clear and timely in the way I teach my patient psychoeducation? Teach my patient what we're trying to accomplish here, and are the techniques that I'm using techniques that make sense to this particular person? So, given all the CBTs, kind of a central location for all of them is in the components. They all should have these components. And now I want to take, this is something I've never done in a talk before, and I'm kind of excited about it. I've talked a lot about the essential components of cognitive behavioral therapy, but of late I've been dividing them into process and content domains. You can see in slide 13, cognitive behavioral therapy may be conveniently divided into content and process domains. The content of CBT is what needs to be changed, like the skills and knowledge that are considered important and often determined by the theoretical model. So ACT would emphasize acceptance and commitment as content, important content. Cognitive therapy would focus specifically on unhelpful basic beliefs and automatic thoughts. REBT would focus specifically on cognitive distortions, among other things. And MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, might focus on mindfulness. I didn't list behavioral activation here, but behavioral activation also would focus for skills and knowledge on the importance of scheduling, on the importance of having behaviors that are consistent with one's value system. And then psychoeducation and techniques, of the 5 components, psychoeducation and techniques focus specifically on content, what you want people to learn and knowledge-wise, and preparing them for certain skill development. And then the specific techniques themselves are aimed at practicing specific skills. So again, if cognitive behavioral therapy isn't working, there's a good chance that that any of the five components need your attention, but specifically, it could be the content. It may be you're trying to focus on acceptance and commitment when the person is dealing with a problem that that is not best addressed through acceptance and commitment. So it could be that the content that you're focusing on as a therapist isn't optimal. But also, if you flip the page on to page 8 and look at slide number 15, it's more likely that the process of cognitive behavioral therapy is what's problematic. The process of CBT is how change is facilitated, what really goes on in the session between therapist and patient. So the process of CBT is most associated with common factors like empathy and acceptance and support and confidentiality and management of expectations. So that's the process of CBT, and that involves structure and collaboration. How much structure do you expect to have, do you plan to have, do you want to have in any given session with a patient? Do you want to strictly adhere to a certain order? Do you want to be particularly organized? I would hope so. You know, what are the kind of the rules of engagement? How much do you expect the patient to talk or the client to talk? What pace do you expect the session to move at? How focused does it need to be? Is it okay if they go from talking about how difficult the day was to their cat is sick to their cat's name is Puss in Boots and the cat the veterinary expenses have been out of control? I mean, how much structure, how organized, how ordered does this session need to be for this particular patient? And collaboration, again, as part of the process. Structure and collaboration are process components. The establishment of common goals. You know, I stuck on this slide that personal style is also influential. I'm not going to say much about that, except that my hope is that all of us can adapt our personal style to the needs or to the style of the patient to the extent that that's reasonable and adaptive, because that's part of the process. But while we're on process, and since I'm claiming that structure is part of the process, slide 16, recommended structure, you know, I've always been a fan, regardless of whether I am delivering ACT or whether I'm engaging in behavioral activation or whether I am doing more of a rational emotive behavior therapy or whether I'm doing cognitive therapy. I've always thought it best to have the structure that you see on page 8 and slide number 16. I've always found it really important to collaboratively set an agenda right at the beginning, saying, what would you like to work on with me? What do you think is most important here? And really to check mood to make sure they're on board with the session or they're not. I'm not focusing on addiction when they've just gone through a tragic week and that's what their mind is on. As a result, they feel worried and anxious and confused about whether they should be adhering to my agenda or talking about their troubling week. Bridging from the last visit, prioritizing and addressing agenda items, capsule summaries. So the list at the bottom of page 8, the structure, regardless of whether you're doing ACT or DBT or behavioral activation, just getting people on board by having them set their agenda, giving you their mood, bridging, those kinds of things. But the most important item on this page, on this slide on page 8, number 16, is the 6th one down, and that's eliciting feedback throughout. If you want to know why CBT isn't working, in a 45-minute session, it's not a bad idea once or twice, or under some circumstances, if things don't seem like they're right, just getting feedback. Questions like, what are you getting out of this session? What are your thoughts about what we're doing? To what extent does what we're talking about align with what's most important to you? You know, the most obvious answer for what to consider when CBT for addictions is not working, the most obvious answer is ask the patient, elicit that feedback. So structure will help, because if the client or patient is on board with the structure, if you follow that structure and it's their agenda and you know what their mood is and you've bridged from last visits and said, I know we've been working on this, that, and the other thing, and as long as you prioritize your agenda items, it doesn't matter whether you're doing ACT or CBT, ACT or CT or REBT or DBT. You really are making sure that they are committed to a session where you are following their agenda and you're attentive to their mood and whether or not they're benefiting from the session. Now, on page 9, what I consider the most important of the 5 components of therapy for establishing cognitive behavioral therapy that does work, the most important component of the 5, structure, collaboration, case conceptualization, psychoeducation techniques, the most important of all of those is case conceptualization. It is the collection and integration of relevant information. It is ongoing when done right. It is ever-evolving. It's a process of formulating and testing hypotheses throughout so that you're not working. Some people say, what are the patient's goals for this therapy with you? Well, it really may vary from visit. It will vary from visit to visit, their goals. And their goals are part of your case conceptualization of them. So it's a collection and integration of relevant information, ongoing, ever-evolving. It requires a solid foundation of empathy. Empathy, not sympathy. Empathy, not compassion. Sympathy and compassion are fine, but it's empathy, which is understanding, that helps you figure out who is this person I am trying to help so that I can help them in a way that matches their needs. So case conceptualization is profoundly influenced by a person's theoretical model. The focal points you pay attention to when you are conceptualizing a patient, the focal points. Again, if you're an ACT therapist, it's going to be you want to ask questions about the extent to which they accept the life they have, or that they do what they commit to do. Or again, I'm picking behavioral activation and ACT for no reason in particular, except that it's popping into my head. Behavioral activation, when you're doing your case conceptualization, you will want to know, you know, what do you do that you enjoy? What do you do that's within your value system? To what extent do you do that? What's most important to you? To what extent does that align with your values? So the case conceptualization identifies deficits as well as targets for change. And it is, as I said earlier, the most important of the 5 components of therapy, because management of the other components depends on it. If you have a good case conceptualization, you decide how you want to structure a session based on how tolerant a person is of structure. That's part of your case conceptualization. A good case conceptualization will give you an idea of exactly how to collaborate with somebody. Some people want a warm, fuzzy relationship with a therapist. Some people want a technician. And your case conceptualization will help you imagine what it is that they want and then test that. Same goes with psychoeducation. Once you conceptualize the patient, again, keeping in mind that empathy is the foundation for a good case conceptualization, when you have identified who your patient is, who your client is, then you can start to decide, I think this type of psychoeducation might be helpful. Maybe they need to learn how to accept what they, you know, the lot they've they live in. Maybe they need to accept that, you know, they're always going to be a little bit anxious, or maybe they need to accept that frustration is inevitable in the world, and resisting it with drugs and alcohol is just going to make it worse. So case conceptualization, vitally important. And then I've come up with a system for case conceptualization that at least serves me well, and that's at the bottom of page 9 and the top of page 10, slides 18 and 19. I actually take those 10, is it 10? I actually take those 10 case conceptualization points and turn them into a case conceptualization worksheet. So primary problems, what is the person saying? What are they saying is their primary problem, or what are their primary problems? That's an obvious one, but social and environmental context is sometimes or often overlooked by therapists. Somebody who lives with a smoker obviously is going to have a more difficult time quitting than someone who doesn't live with a smoker. Somebody who is a binge eater who survives on $25,000 a year income on a fixed income, and they binge eat pasta and they have nothing else in their lives, needs to have their context understood. Somebody who lives in a neighborhood where certain behaviors, where everyone drinks every night together, and if you don't drink with them, you're not part of the crew. That context is vital for understanding. If you really want to dig into what to consider when CBT isn't working, it's not a bad idea to say, what context do you live in? What are the influences that trigger you? What are the influences that cause you to maintain that behavior that you're so desperate to stop? And then let's go to number three, distal antecedents, especially opioid addictions. People who have a family history of addictions are obviously at much higher risk, but there's a genetic component to addictions. And understanding that in trying to help somebody to quit an addictive behavior in particular, or if you're dealing with depression or anxiety, family history is really important. And it could be because there's the genetic component, but also distally, meaning out in the distant, there are overlearned processes that need to be addressed as you work with people who are having trouble changing their behaviors. Proximal antecedents, number four, are internal and external cues and triggers in high-risk situations. Five is cognitive processes. I am particularly fond, and this is important here, this is maybe one of the most valuable pearls I've learned when dealing with therapy not working. I've read the work of Daniel Kahneman, is familiar with the System 1 and System 2 thinking. System 1 is the automatic process that enables us to get up in the morning and use the restroom and shower and brush our teeth and eat breakfast without a lot of careful thought. Well, when people develop maladaptive patterns, System 1 is driving those. And System 1 is very stubborn. It likes to stay right where it is and continue the existing by itself. System 2 is this deliberate, intentional, hardworking part of a person that's required to make any changes. It is slow, deliberate, and so to the extent that people have deeply embedded ideas about what the value is of their drinking or smoking or snorting or shooting, to the extent that they have a lot of automatic System 1 thoughts, like this is my only path to happiness or this is the only thing that takes the pain away, those kinds of automatic thoughts are really important for a therapist to understand if they're going to address why CBT might not be working. Deeply held, long-standing thought processes. Affectively, I'm on the top of page 10 in the new outline, number 19. Affectively, all you have to do is hear the phrase self-medicating, and you understand why affective processes are important. To the extent that people use a variety of behaviors to quell their pain, their psychological suffering, it's going to be really important to figure out with them what's going to take the place of an addictive behavior. So long-standing, uncomfortable, painful suffering, feelings, moods, even physiologic sensations like pain need to be understood in order to understand why therapy might not be working. Behavior patterns, to what extent is the behavior, the addictive behavior, part of a compensatory strategy? And, of course, number eight, readiness to change and associated goals. You know, I'm going to say when I summarize, readiness to change brings to mind the concept of meet people where they're at, but that's such a huge oversimplification. People, readiness to change is not a stable process. And even if I come to you today and say, I never want to touch, I never want to drink alcohol again for the rest of my life, you'll think to yourself, well, you're beyond contemplation. You'll ask me when the last time I drank was, and I'll say 3 days ago, and you'll say, wow, you're in the action stage. Well, I'm in the action stage while I'm sitting here with you, but as soon as I get that call from my neighbor saying, come on over and have a glass of wine, all of a sudden I'm in pre-contemplation. So I said earlier that case conceptualization is ever-evolving, and if therapy isn't working, it is vitally important to ask yourself, have I updated the case conceptualization recently enough? You know, readiness to change was high when I first met her, but is it still, has it changed? Have the goals changed accordingly? Then integrating it all and the implications for treatment. So to summarize all things I just said, if you want to focus intently on why CBT might not be working, the place to look first is case conceptualization. And that'll help you make some decisions about the other components of therapy, like how structured, how collaborative, how much education, and how do the techniques fit given the present case conceptualization. You know, as you look at case conceptualization, let's just also look at some common sense kind of issues. Slide 20, page 10, you know, some people come to therapy because they've been pressured to enter treatment. Some people come with profound feelings of shame, and they don't want to tell a stranger what they feel. That can interfere with treatment. People tend to minimize things that have had benefits to them in the past, and so rather than stigmatizing somebody who doesn't seem motivated to change, just understanding that it's logical that people will want to minimize something, problems associated with something that they've wanted to do in the past. You know, a lot of people don't come to therapy with unsatisfying experiences with past professionals or stereotypic views of therapies and therapy and therapists. And so checking all that can be really valuable. Fearing that self-disclosure is going to result in punishment, like legal punishment. Not having the resources, individuals not having the resources, and even the reasons why they use these are all like common sense parts of the case conceptualization that can really help you figure out what's going on there. Now, Jeremy Safran has done a lot, and his colleagues have done a lot of really important and valuable work with therapeutic ruptures. And I just want to draw your attention to it. I've written the reference at the bottom. You know, an alliance rupture, which is also a process kind of rupture in cognitive behavioral therapy and all therapies, is when there's an impairment or fluctuation in the alliance between therapist and client. And it's you know, it's interesting. If you look down at the bottom of page 11, there are, according to them, this is an older reference, there are many, many new references and new research papers on ruptures, but this is a good basic one that I've referenced. You know, people can overtly say, this therapy sucks, but more often the communication about this therapy sucking or this therapy not working for me, more often it's more indirect, number two on my list here. It's indirect communication about it not working. Some people can say, if somebody comes to you and they say, I've been drinking a fifth a night and everyone in my family was an alcoholic, I want to control my drinking, which, by the way, somebody said, I'm not just saying this, somebody said this to me this past week. Very strong family history. They drink a fifth of alcohol a night, and they want to engage in controlled drinking. Well, you are going to disagree in your head about the realistic nature of that aim, but disagreement over the goals can really be among the worst sources of rupture. Sometimes people say they do everything you tell them to do. That can be a rupture, and you can read the others. There are all these different ways that a therapeutic relationship can be ruptured, but what's interesting is that sometimes they are nearly invisible. They are you don't even know they're happening. So being attuned to that process. And I'm looking at the top of page 23. Recommendations, just attend to them. Be aware of your own feelings. Accept responsibility. A rupture is when therapy, a rupture is simply when therapy isn't working, and even just for a moment. So as I get into the home stretch and I want to leave at least 10 minutes for conversation, therapists and relationship factors, you know, therapists, in order to be adaptive to the wide range of patients we see in therapy, and they, in order to be adaptive, have to have a pretty substantial, I'm on the bottom of page 12, by the way, a pretty deep and substantial knowledge or skill base. But perhaps more importantly, we have to be flexible. We cannot be rigid in our aims or goals. It's really tough in a clinical trial for psychotherapy. So a lot of times the problems presented, if you really conceptualize the patient, the problems presented are not consistent with the aims of the protocol. And that can be really problematic. So therapist flexibility, also therapist temperament. A real warm, fuzzy therapist is great, but for some patients, they're not great. Authenticity, immediacy, openness, they're all desirable characteristics, but an optimum level. And maybe the last line under therapist factors is the most important, just a willingness to be curious throughout. Instead of thinking, you know, he ought to be doing this, my patient ought to be doing this, the thought probably should be, I wonder why this isn't working. So only through deliberate practice, intentional, rigorous examination of what we're doing, can we figure out why CBT isn't working. And it involves the conceptualization, but also some self-reflection. And it's always important to check on common goals and shared expectations and the alliance and recognition and repair of ruptures. Finally, before I go into a summary, patient factors, again, case conceptualization, interpersonal or attachment style skills and resources are important. People will vary greatly in how close they want you to be to them. Some people will think, if you seem too much like you want to like them, it will scare them off. And if you seem kind of distant and clinical, it will scare other people off. Patients' intellectual and abstraction skills, their emotion regulation skills, impulse control skills, their cognitive flexibility and motivation to change, constantly changing, those are personal resources and skills. And then social determinants of health, which I called context earlier. Economic stability, education, those kinds of things. So constantly saying, when it feels like this isn't going right, constantly asking, what's going on here? Which of these myriad of problems could be the one or the many ones that are problematic? So I'm going to wind up with my summary. I start with my summary. CBT is effective. There's a literature out there. If you want more, go look at common factors, therapist effects, ruptures, and supervision. Next to last page. That question of what to do when therapy isn't working is complex. Answers can only be found microscopically by looking super carefully at a bunch of different variables, like how is the therapist responding, and then how is the therapist responding to the patient's barriers. Now, this is going to be the fun slide for me to read, okay? I'm on page 14 bottom. I wrote this and it made me chuckle, so I'm going to hopefully make you chuckle even though you're on mute. CBT models are plentiful. Some advertise themselves as third wave, but they actually all grew up together. And they really did. I remember back in the 90s standing outside of a conference with Stephen Hayes and Marsha Linehan and Tim Beck, and we were all talking about cognitive behavioral therapy, and we were all doing it, but everyone had their own little niche. But like siblings, some are older and some are younger siblings. but not by much. Don't be fooled by sibling rivalry. None of those are superior. ACT isn't superior. None of those are superior. It's important to love them all equally because, like siblings, they all have their strengths and weaknesses. They're all lovable in their own ways. So therapists should get to know all of them because they're all they all meet different needs as a function of patients' individual differences. So, finally, curiosity, determination, flexibility, and therapist range are all essential. Accurate case conceptualizations are essential. Meet people where they're at is a nice idea, but it's really hard to when they're ever-changing and a moving target. So the questions to ask yourself include, one, where does my patient want to go? Two, what's keeping them from getting there? And three, when is it time to simply accept where they're at? That's the end. We have some time to chat if anybody has questions or discussions. Please keep in mind that there are probably over 40 people on the call. We'll try to get a few people in if we can. And everyone on the call who expected credit needs to shoot me an email and just attest to the fact that you are on the whole call. And if you want to ask a question, you have to get off the
mute. Bruce, it's Mark, and I have more of a comment than a question. I mean, this is all great stuff, and it seems to me that it transcends CBT or any one kind of therapy. I mean, the issues on therapeutic ruptures is that's a much broader area.
I know. I agree with you 100%. Yes, 100%. Other thoughts, questions? Thank you, Mark.
Stunned silence.
That's all right.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you would mind sharing with us one example of when you finally started to get an idea that the relationship or the therapy wasn't working. What was it that triggered it for you, and how did you address it in a way that tried to maintain the therapeutic alliance and allowed you to work together on fixing the therapy or getting the therapy to work? One sort of example would be terrific. Thank
no
you.
Problem. Do you mind if it's like an initial session?
Oh, yeah, that would be terrific. Thank you.
Absolutely. So a lot of the literature on cognitive behavioral therapy says that early on, and this is also, I think, an ethics sort of mandate, that that patients should be provided with full disclosure of what the therapy entails. And just watching a person's eyes as I describe this, if they start to look like their eyes are glazing over, or or they just look distracted or a little bit, I don't know, lost, at that point, it's time for me to say, hey, let me just ask you if you have any thoughts about what I've said so far, the extent to which it corresponds with what you hoped for here. Maybe you can help me make sure that I'm on track to respond to any of it. So a lot of times it's nonverbal cues, like seeing facial expressions. Sometimes it's much more overt, like, you didn't let me finish my sentence, or in which case I will oftentimes, to get it back on track, apologize and say, please continue so I hear the rest of your sentence or what you were saying, and I wait and listen for the whole thing and try to respond to the content, but then turn to the process and say, I might sometimes try to redirect you, and it may seem like I'm interrupting you. If that's the case, please let me know. I promise you it's just because I want to be helpful. And sometimes I'll say, I'm stopping you here only because I have information overload. I really want to help you, but you've given me so much information. So I just had someone return yesterday who left therapy because he was missing a lot of appointments and he said they were for valid reasons. And I said, I think I need to put you on my wait list because I've had a lot of open spots, and you know, because you've missed appointments. And he came back after 6 months because he felt like I abandoned him by putting him on my wait list. And I apologized and explained to him that we just need to figure out an alternative. So it's usually by trying to be humble and hearing what the rupture was and making sure I can kind of meet him where, as I said earlier, kind of meet him where he's at today. I hope that's helpful.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Other questions?
I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I
actually
was wondering...
it sounds a little echoey. Are you on a speakerphone? Might you just be able to...
I'm on Google, actually. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm on Google through my computer. All right. So I was wondering... if there are times when you identify that it's not switching to a different type of CBT that is needed, but possibly like a completely different type of therapy itself, for example, like, maybe like identifying when grief is the main issue, and so you would switch into not a modality that's concerned mainly with the cognition and behavior, but, you know, a different realm altogether that's not about, like, control or management, but, like, grief, grief treatment is outside of those agendas.
I have on many occasions said to people, it seems like what you're asking for is, and rather than come up with a label like grief treatment, I might say it sounds like you're, and I may have grief treatment in my head, but what I'll say is it sounds like you would benefit significantly from an experience where there was less structure, you had more of a chance to just talk about these things. And if a person says yes, without the label, I might know of a colleague that is more focused in the area that they're in. Like, there's no one better trauma therapy than others. All good trauma therapy is good trauma therapy, but working through trauma might be a different process for some people than others. So somebody who does more of whatever the patient needs, it might be more listening, more acceptance, more support. So if it would be nice if just the labels were a good prediction of what the therapy would actually be like. But a lot of times,
right,
therapists say, I specialize in grief, and I come to learn that, you know, they ended up talking, the person comes back to me and said, all they talked about was my childhood, and this grief was my husband's death, over my husband's death. And so I like to pair up people with clinicians that seem to function in the mode that this person needs. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it sounds like that patient then has more than one therapist, at least for some period of time.
Yeah, or they can have just one, or they can just see another person and come back to me if they want.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those questions. Looks like we've reached 2 o'clock, 1 o'clock my time.
We've made it to 2 o'clock.
Everybody who is planning to get credit for this, please send me an email right away, and we'll get you moving into the credit side.
Listen, I want to thank you, Bruce. This is really great, and I think a really appropriate thing. Appropriate topics, and I hope everybody can join us on March 13th for Scott Kellogg, and if there are any other questions or comments, feel free to email me or email Bruce directly.
Thank you very much.
Bye, everybody. See you next month.
Bye-bye. Thanks
bye.
So much.
All right.
Mark, it's George. Mark?